Welcome to Living Orthodoxy, an invitation to a deeper life in Christ, a podcast of St. Philip Orthodox Church in Souderton, Pennsylvania, dedicated to connecting the liturgical and spiritual life of the Orthodox parish with the life of the Orthodox home, presenting the weekly homilies of our parish pastors, Father Noah Buscelli and Father James Thayer, as well as discussions of the liturgical year and Orthodox life and practice by Justin Gold and Jeff Hyatt.
Some are scared of freezing rain, but Dr. Mary reminded us not to be afraid of prison or death, but only to fear God. And Dr. David has a similar thing to say, but now from the text of church history and the life and tribulation of St. John Chrysostom and his close collaborator, St. Olympiada. Is it the same name? Either one is the same, yeah. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your preparation, your love, your energy, and sharing with us.
Wow. So good to be here, sharing some of the good things of the Lord together. Everything Mary was saying, kind of in a more general way, just like Father was starting to say, we have this whole theme of enduring suffering nobly, patiently, with great hope, right? Hopefulness. Now we have an amazing, really, example of all of this in the lives of two of our saints, St. John Chrysostom, whom we all love somewhat to know, probably quite a bit about, and his friend, confidant, perhaps his best friend. They were certainly kindred spirits, the deaconess Olympia. They worked together for 6 years. St. John was made the Archbishop of Constantinople in 398, coming from Antioch, his hometown. St. Olympia was a resident of Constantinople. He had been made a deaconess by St. John's predecessor, the Archbishop Nectarios. So she had been a deaconess for some years. She was fantastically wealthy, an heiress, inheriting estates far and wide, big and small. She inherited all of this as a young woman around the age of 20 or so, maybe even earlier. So it's a testimony to her maturity that the emperor himself actually had chosen. She was married and then lost her husband after about 20 months. And the emperor had personally chosen one of his cousins, I think, to be her new husband, and she said, no, I will be devoted to my husband forever, and I'm dedicating the rest of my life to the church. And the emperor was ready to take her inheritance, actually, and kind of put it in trust. He thought she was too young to handle it herself, and she said, okay, that's fine. That will relieve me of all the burden of what to do with all of this money. And then, so the emperor said, oh, all right, just take it. If you're going to be that way. So she was pretty feisty, too. Just a remarkable woman. Here is the collection of letters that I was incredibly blessed and honored to be able to translate. 17 letters that St. John wrote to Olympia after he was sent into exile. And in my talk, I'll get into a little bit of what brought that about. But his major concern is for her well-being, especially her emotional well-being. Her foundations were so shaken He was her spiritual father. He was only about 13 years older than she. She devoted one of the palaces that she inherited, turned it into a monastery for women. It adjoined the great church. So when John comes from Antioch in 398, there's immediately a close connection. They share so many things together concerning the spiritual life and the love for scripture and so on. They became very close. She would serve his meals for him. She was especially concerned about his diet because he suffered from stomach problems, going back to his days of severe asceticism as a young man. So they had all of this wonderful life together, and then it just comes crashing to a halt when he is terribly unjustly sent into exile. So this is basically the background for the letters. He starts writing to her immediately as he's being taken overland from Constantinople to a place in Eastern Asia Minor, Eastern Turkey today. Kind of a wild, sparsely inhabited area, mountainous area. There were even marauding tribes who were dangerous. His stomach ailments, the cold was especially difficult for him to endure. But his major concern is for her. And as I said, I was able to translate these letters. Only 6 out of the 17 had ever been published in English. And that was back in the 1880s, in a format that isn't too readily appealing. In the NPNF series, double columns, small print, Victorian-style English. So those really needed to be redone too, and then the other 11 had never appeared in English before. So it was just amazing.
Dr. Fuller, was this the exile in which he died?
Yeah, the exile in which he died. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So it was like St. John saved these letters for me to do. I had worked on his, with his writings in doing my dissertation. So I was familiar with his style. I was familiar with using the Greek. Of course, there I was coming through the dictionary over and over in the translation process. But I really felt like he was helping me, and just, I don't know, our own relationship got strengthened. I owe him so much, so much. He's helped me in my teaching so much, among other things. When I did my dissertation for a year and a half, the main thing I did was read his writings. So, and did kind of a vast indexing project. So, with that as an introduction, let's go into what I have here. On a sultry night in June, in the year 404, in the grand, glittering capital city of the Roman Empire, Constantinople, the Christian city founded by St. Constantine the Great, named for him, the foundations of the life of a young widow and deaconess named Olympia were suddenly tremendously shaken. That's, of course, the theme of our retreat, right? Indeed, it could be said her world was falling apart. This happened because that night, St. John Chrysostom, her beloved spiritual father, teacher, confidant, fellow servant in the Lord, and rock of support, and the archbishop of the city, was whisked away by imperial guards to be taken into a faraway exile from which he would never return. And what made
This all the more torturous for Olympia to bear was the fact that John had been deposed from his position as archbishop and arrested and sent into exile, not only totally unjustly, but illegally. Through the machinations of the emperor who had turned against him, Arcadius, he was very much influenced by his wife, the Empress Evdoxia, the stronger of the two in terms of their personality, and through the jealousy and resentment of many bishops and priests who had turned against him, led by Theophilus, the Archbishop of Alexandria, who was stirred probably by jealousy of St. John, who was the greatest preacher in the Christian world. And that's really the reason he was taken from Antioch up to Constantinople to be the new archbishop there, because of his tremendous renown as a preacher. We don't have time to go into all the details of what led to this really outrageous series of events, but it's easy to see why this all would have made Olympia feel like her world had been turned upside down. And the months after his being carried off into exile were times of great difficulty for Olympia and all those called Johnites, who refused to accept the authority of John's successor as Archbishop of Constantinople, a weak man named Arsacius. The Johnites were slandered and persecuted in any number of ways. One of their number, a priest named Tigrius, was stripped of his clothes, scourged on the back, bound hand and foot, and stretched on the rack, according to Sozomen, one of the early church historians. The cataclysm that had struck the church, with the archbishop of the leading city in the empire being illegally deposed and sent into exile, just unimaginable, really. And with his faithful followers terribly persecuted by their fellow Christians, this was all so severe that St. John, in one of his letters to Olympia, compared it to a sea forced open to the depths of the abyss, revealing corpses floating on the waves, others submerged beneath them, the bridges of the ships destroyed, the sails in shreds, the masts shattered, the oars fallen out of the hands of the oarsmen, the pilots seated upon the decks in front of the tillers, with their hands crossed over their knees, and in the face of their impotence before these events, they are groaning, crying out in anguish, lamenting, wailing, with nothing clearly seen, neither the sky nor the sea, but with everything plunged into deep darkness, with such obscurity and gloom that upon turning around it's impossible to recognize one's neighbor, and with the sailors everywhere beset by crashing waves and by monsters of the sea. That's how he starts his seventh letter in the series. Olympia herself was twice brought into court to face charges of arson because a fire had broken out in the great church in the midst of all the confusion that night when he was taken away off into exile. The fire was blamed on her, or at least her and other of John's followers. That fire was really serious. Burned down the church and the Senate building across the way. But what does she tell the judge? Something like, "I have spent much of my fortune in building churches. I'm not in the habit of seeing them get destroyed."
Yeah.
So the charges, thankfully, were dropped. Meanwhile, as I said, John began sending letters to her very soon after he's taken into exile to assure her of his own well-being, to inquire after her health and welfare, and most especially to help her emerge from and stay out of the grip of despondency that she was very much vulnerable to, falling into despondency because of what had happened. For her part, Since she and the rest of John's most devoted followers were suffering varying degrees of persecution, as we've said, from those who had unjustly maneuvered to get John exiled, her physical welfare was very much in danger. But her worst affliction was indeed her tendency to fall into despondency, perhaps even deep despondency. So difficult was it for her to accept what had happened in the church to her beloved spiritual father and to so many of his supporters, and of course to Shirley missing him so much, his presence. And I've mentioned the digestive problems that he was suffering from. She was concerned about that. You know, who is going to watch his diet now that she can't do it anymore? So it's no wonder that this sensitive soul fell into despondency in the midst of all this anxiety and heartache. So now we're going to turn to the letters and see how he encourages her, all the ways he endeavors to bring her out of despondency. He is convinced that despondency can be willfully overcome through proper thinking. He's very strong on this, as we'll see. Thinking about things from a spiritual perspective. Exactly what Mary was emphasizing that the book of Revelation does, right? Looking at everything happening in this world, good or bad, from the heavenly perspective. There's much more than just the power of positive thinking involved here, although we can identify with, and there's a lot of truth just in that, you know. Things are most likely going to go better for us if we're thinking positively rather than negatively. But with Christians, of course, everything is set in reverse. Everything, right? St. Paul says, bringing every thought into captivity of obedience to Christ. Very powerful phrase there. 2 Corinthians 10:5. Bringing every thought of ours into the captivity of obedience to Christ. Hence, okay, immediately after Chrysostom's dramatic description of what I just read, using all that imagery of sailors in a storm, he says, however, even when I see such things, I do not give up an even firmer hope as I consider the pilot, capital P, who governs all things, who prevails over storms, who calms the raging gale, not through skill and artfulness, but with a single nod. So, okay, most of what he writes to her in these letters is devoted to urging her in many varying ways to reject harmful thoughts. And do you know the Greek word that we use almost as a technical term for these kinds of harmful negative thoughts? Logismi. Logismi. Yeah. It really just means thoughts. But in a technical sense, it means harmful, deleterious, negative thoughts that afflict us and that can be rejected. So many people, I think, maybe go through their whole life and don't realize that not every thought they get is really from God or from their true selves or however you want to say it. There are thoughts that come from the evil one. Or from the fallenness of our flesh or whatever. And we need to learn how to identify these thoughts and reject them. So much of what he says in these letters is directed along this line. Especially these thoughts, second thoughts is a huge problem, right? We make a mistake and we hammer ourselves for what we should have done. The devil can use that so easily. In her case, it's just maybe wondering how could all of this have ever happened? You know, why did it happen? These kinds of things, right? This is the fundamental purpose, I think, of his, that we find him, that's so central in these letters. He says in letter 14, okay, here's an example. Therefore, he says, leave off considering, just stop thinking about the plots, the insults, the loss of your possessions, being continually uprooted, living in a foreign country. Now, this is after he's been in exile a couple years, and she has been more or less sent out of Constantinople. So she's living in a foreign land now, probably in Western Asia Minor somewhere. So he's saying, leave off considering, you know, feeling sorry for yourself. Trample upon all these things, he says, as if they were more paltry than mud. Think rather about the treasures that are laid up for you in the heavens, things that cannot be taken away, riches that cannot be plundered. I add here, it's very interesting that this emphasis on proper thinking as the key to getting out of and staying out of despondency, / despair, / depression, varying degrees, right, of the same kind of thing, is the hallmark of the widespread clinical approach in modern psychology to a certain method. What am I going to say? You know? That's a psychological method. Therapists use it. Directed specifically towards our thinking. Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. Yeah. There's a classic work on this in this field. The title says a lot. 3-Minute Therapy, : Change Your Thinking, Change Your Life, by a professional in this field, Michael Edelstein. Okay, the affinity of some basic aspects of this approach with sound orthodox spirituality can be seen as one example among many in the teachings of the renowned Serbian elder of our own time. You may be familiar with this book. It's by the elder Thaddeus of Vitovnica. Do you remember the title? Our Thoughts Determine Our Lives. Wow. We might not want to press that title to the hilt. You know, we don't want to get into a determinism kind of thing, but it says a lot. There's a lot of truth in it, right? Our thoughts certainly very much influence our lives. And you may know of a book by Father Alexis Trader. Was on Mount Atlas for a while. Before that, he was one of our students at St. Tikhon's, was a monk there. He and our Metropolitan Tikhon were best friends. Then he went to Mount Athos, had to leave there because of health reasons. But he wrote a book called Ancient Christian Wisdom and Aaron Beck's Cognitive Behavioral Therapy, A Meeting of Minds, where he describes how close, really, CBT is in many ways to Orthodox spiritual guidance. Okay, so let's come back to the letters, and let's see how these words ring in our own ears. Can they be helpful? As I say here, in the midst of our frenetic way of life, over 1,600 years later, in the 21st century, in which, like Mary was saying, we are so constantly bombarded with news of tragedies around the world. And then, of course, our own various difficulties, trials, and tragedies that may that we're all, you know, we're all vulnerable in one way or another to falling into despondency or despair. So let's see how much we can relate to what he says. Okay, first of all, John makes clear to Olympia, he fully understands the fierceness of the grip that despondency can have on people. This is from letter 10. So this is a longer passage here. And now it is necessary to prepare for you swords and lances, bows and arrows, breastplates, shields, and leg armor. Obviously bringing in a lot of military imagery, right? And I'm sure he has, what's that great chapter in Ephesians? Put on the whole armor of God, right? Chapter 6, Ephesians, I'm sure he's got that in mind. He's amplifying, right? In order for you to defend yourself and to cast down and demolish and leave for dead the troubling thoughts that assail you. So you see them as enemies. And where will we gather those enemies and projectiles for you so that you might not only prevent your enemies from coming close, but that you might chase them very far away with much violence? He says, we will understand the enemy by looking at despondency, at the nature of despondency itself. Kind of like know your enemy, right? By the way, the Greek word is aphemia, despondency, which really kind of also means without energy, kind of just listless, just like a used up wash rag or something, you know, nothing left. Aphemia, A-T-H-U-M-I-A. The opposite would be kind of enthumia. We get our word enthusiasm. When you're filled with life and energy. See, the opposite of that. When you're empty. Empty. Okay. And he speaks as if he knows about this firsthand. Despondency is for souls a grievous torture chamber. Unspeakably painful. More fierce and bitter than every ferocity and torment. It imitates the poisonous worm that attacks not only the body but also the soul, and not only the bones but also the mind. It's a continual executioner who not only tears in pieces one's torso but also mutilates the strength of one's soul. It is a continuous night, darkness with no light, a tempest, a gale, an unseen fever burning more powerfully than any flame, a war having no relief, a disease which casts a shadow over nearly everything visible. For even the sun and the air seem to be oppressive to those who are suffering from despondency. And midday even seems to be as dark as So he knows what he's talking about when he's trying to lift her out of this kind of state. He knows how difficult it is. One more paragraph from this letter. Wherefore the marvelous prophet says, to indicate this, the sun set for them at midday. Prophet Amos, chapter 8, verse 9. He said this not because this heavenly body had actually disappeared or had broken from its customary course, but because to the despondent soul, the brightest moment of the day appears as night. For the darkness of night is not like the night of despair, which is not sustained by the order of nature, but is produced by the darkness of thoughts. See, the darkness of thoughts, which are fearful and unbearable. Having a cruel visage, more savage than any tyrant, not yielding easily to anyone reaching out to destroy it, despondency often renders the soul it has seized to be harder than steel or just kind of like brass when that soul is not filled with much wisdom. He's saying, you know, when, especially when the person doesn't know about this whole phenomenon of logismi. In the same letter, he also explains that despondency is, quote, more grievous than all evils, even more grievous than death. But he offers her comfort in knowing that just to endure such suffering, which despondency brings about, will bring great reward. As he says to her, quote, but however debilitating this fear of death is, as I've shown, and even in the experience of those saints I've mentioned, that is easier to bear than despondency. For it is for this reason that I have extended myself in writing this double course of words, so that I may teach you that whatever price you pay, you will receive in its place a much greater corresponding recompense of good things. So then, he says, expect great rewards for such torture that you're enduring. Many prizes, recompense beyond description, brilliant, abundantly blossoming crowns for such agony. Just as long as you keep bearing it, as long as you don't give in, right? As long as you are staying in the fight. And then he says, for it is not only for the good one does, but also for the evil one suffers, that one obtains many rewards and great prizes. Pretty remarkable. I'm already proceeding to this powerful exhortation for you and for all those having need of it, to train them in patience, to instill courage, and not to leave in a weakened state those who are struggling against such misfortunes. He goes on immediately to suggest that enduring suffering may even be more deserving of great rewards from God than doing virtuous deeds. He says that despondency is more grievous than all evils, that it is the height and head of fearful things. Our discourse has already sufficiently demonstrated. Now it remains for us to tie together virtues and sufferings so that you may learn clearly that it's not only for virtues but also for sufferings that there are great rewards. Even extremely great rewards, he says, and for sufferings no less than for virtues. And indeed, he says, this may even be more so for sufferings. At the same time, though, he repeatedly emphasizes, this doesn't mean wallowing in our sufferings, okay? It's how we respond to them, right? He says, we cannot wallow in our sufferings with complaining, being immersed in self-pity. This will not bring reward. Rather, these rewards come only when one endures the suffering graciously, nobly, without complaining. For example, he says in letter 10, quote, but if one suffers and bears it nobly and with meekness glorifies God for everything, then that one will be rewarded. Further, he says, quote, therefore, meditating upon these things and considering how great is the reward for a painful and toilsome life, rejoice and be glad, since from your youth you have trodden a path full of a myriad of crowns, making profit, like Mary was saying, make a profit on anything, right? Through your continual and multitudinous suffering. For bodily infirmity, in all its various forms, is more grievous than a myriad of deaths, since without ceasing it continually beleaguers you, being showered with abuses and outrages, bearing calumnies, slanders, right, against yourself without a pause, being overwhelmed with continual extreme sadness and fountains of tears throughout all this time. Each one of these trials is sufficient by itself to procure great advantage to those who endure such things patiently. So, no matter how fierce the grip, the pressure, the torture of the despondency, Chrysostom is convinced that it can be borne, it can be endured patiently, nobly, without complaining, if one strives for this, if we just try to do this, right? And of course, always with the help of divine grace. Always, always with God's help, right? We can always do nothing without him. So, bearing suffering patiently does bring great reward in heaven. By the way, this was, as I was doing that vast indexing, right, I mentioned, going through all his works, this really was probably his most favorite topic. Almsgiving was another one. Those two. He just loved to talk about this topic, bearing suffering nobly. And I just can't help thinking he preached on this so often for so many years. He's getting older, 57 years old when he was sent into exile. It's like the Lord was saying, John, you've talked about this so often. Now, here's your chance, see, to really live it, to really live it. So, you know, from the heavenly perspective, if anyone was going to be the one to endure this terribly unjust exile, he was the one, because he was so well prepared for it, preaching about it so much himself. How everything works together, you know. Okay, so he says in letter 13, who has ever tired of riches? Who has ever been disturbed upon coming to the most exalted heights? If those who gather human good things, which are perishable, more fleeting than a shadow, or than flowers that are rotting, or rather withering away, such people still can leap for joy, even for perishable things, and dance and flutter with a pleasure that appears, but then quickly disappears, in imitation of the course of a surging stream, how much more is it right for you to rejoice, he's saying. You know, because you're rejoicing in heavenly things that are imperishable. That's what he's saying. For even if you were overwhelmed at first by despondency, the present circumstances afford you the occasion for the greatest joy. For the treasure that you have gathered for yourself is inviolable, and the worthiness that has been forged through these sufferings of yours does not know, nor does it have an end. For it is limitless and cannot be cut short by difficult circumstances or by the plots of men or by the assaults of demons or by death itself. See, nothing can take away those rewards that are being gathered up for her. In letter 14, he speaks to her of God's ineffable love for mankind, that he permitted you to be afflicted with such trials. You know, St. Paul says, God never gives us more than we can handle. That's one of the ironclad promises, right, that we have in the scriptures. 1 Corinthians 10:13, there's no temptation taken you but such as is common to mankind, right? Don't think you're the only one, right? That's another trick the devil tries to play when we're feeling down and out. No one's ever felt this bad, right? It's worse for me than it's ever been for anybody. That's just a lie of the devil. So whatever sufferings come upon us, we can trust that God has somehow already prepared us for enduring them, and that he will give us the strength to endure whatever we need to bear. So he says, thank God that he has permitted you to be afflicted with such trials, one after another, which are succeeding in producing for you such brilliant crowns. See, such favor from God. He says in letter 16, this is in the third year of his exile. It is most natural and reasonable that the succession of trials, one after another, has well toned the sinews of your soul even more, and the contests have increased your zeal and strength, producing in you much delight. For such is the nature of tribulation. When it befalls a noble and vibrant soul, it bears these results. And just as fire renders gold more pure when brought into contact with it, so when tribulation comes upon golden souls, it renders them more pure and more proven. Wherefore, St. Paul says, tribulation works patience, and patience works character. From Romans 5, verses 3 and 4. That's a great passage there. Okay, now here is a turning point in my presentation. As much as we've been talking about bearing despondency patiently, St. John is far from content only to counsel her to bear her despondency meekly and patiently. There's a place for that, and maybe that's a kind of a foundation. But most of the time, he urges her to overthrow it. Okay? To do everything she can with God's help. To throw off this despondency. Remember, what does he think is causing it so much? Thoughts. Logis me, right? That he is convinced can be overthrown. So he says, knowing these things, therefore, my lady, most beloved of God, do not give yourself over to the tyranny of despair, but conquer the storm with your reason, with proper thinking. See? You can do it, he says, for the surging sea is not stronger than your ability to master it. He closes letter 5. Meditating upon these things within yourself and similar things, for we have not stopped chanting such things continually to you, my lady most beloved by God, throw off this heavy burden of despondency. Throw it off. He ends letter 8. Therefore, if you wish to fill us with great joy, which I know you wish for and you have zealously pursued, show us that you have completely chased away the burden of despondency and that you are filled with calm. Give us this recompense for our love for you, agape, our love and care for you. For you know, he says, you know well how to rejuvenate us. Talking about himself. And the Greek word there is very vivid. Anaktesis really means rebuild. Not just rejuvenate me, but rebuild me, which gives an indication of his great love for her. You know, how broken up he is, knowing that she is suffering so much. Rebuild me by succeeding in throwing off this despondency, see, and telling me of that in your letters to me. He starts off letter 9. Why do you lament? Why do you smite yourself, afflicting yourself with pains which even your enemies do not have the power to inflict upon you, as you give your soul over to the tyranny of despair? For the letters which you have sent to us through Patricius, he was one of their couriers, they had to be very careful with whom they entrusted the letters to. He had been sent into exile by the government and the church, you know. They had many enemies. So they had to be careful with even how to deal with their correspondence. For the letters which you have sent to us through Patricius have revealed the wounds of your heart and mind. Wherefore, I also am suffering, see, great pain and distress. Since when you must make every exertion and make it your business to shake off the despondency of your soul, you surround yourself with grievous thoughts, and there's the Greek word again, logismi, even inventing things which don't exist.
Can that happen when we're feeling so low?
We start imagining even worse things, right?
The devil's business, right? The devil's business.
Berating yourself in vain, he says, for no purpose whatsoever, with great harm to yourself.
And then he says near the beginning of letter 10, so this is what we are hastening to do, not only to banish your despondency, but to fill you with great and continual gladness.
This is possible if you are willing, he says.
For the immutable laws of nature do not make it impossible for us to force ourselves to make a change. We can force ourselves. What does Jesus say at one point about the kingdom of heaven? The violent take it by force. So I think this is a point of connection here with the words of Christ. This is possible if you are willing, if you force yourself to make a change. So he says, the power to easily manage our own welfare lies in the free decisions of our will. And in this, our joy resides. And you know this, as you remember from my frequent long discourses, in which I have expended myself in continually bringing forth examples from the history. He's referring to the Old Testament figures, especially. Who would be the greatest example from the Old Testament of enduring suffering? Job. And St. John Chrysostom loves Job. Just incredible. It's incredible how much he loves Job. Because this theme is so important to him, bearing suffering nobly. And you know this, he says, as you remember from my frequent long discourses. Yes, okay. For it is certainly not in the nature of things, but in the will of man that our happiness naturally resides. It's really up to us. God wants us to be filled with inner peace, but we need to do our part to make sure that happens. Just with the power of our thinking. Say, choosing what kinds of thoughts to have. Yeah, okay. A bit further in this letter, he says, knowing this, my lady, most beloved by God, take pains and fight and force yourself to cooperate with what I'm saying. To repel, to chase away with the utmost ardor the thoughts, logis me, troubling you, which are causing you such agitation and such harm. But so that you might accomplish this, holding tightly to our exhortation, you must not have doubts. And then he says, beginning in letter 14, cease therefore your crying and stop torturing yourself with grief. And then near the end of his last letter to her, shortly before his death, letter 17, he says, in considering all of this, drive away the despondency that now envelops you. Judging from her letters to him, which we don't have any of those, but judging from his responses to her, it seems like, you know, she's been up and down with this, which is utterly so typical, right? Anyone who's had experience with despondency, it can lighten, it can get more severe. Times when we're totally free from it, then it can come back, creeping in on us maybe. So this has kind of been how it's been for her, it seems. Drive away the despondency that now envelops you. Do not inflict exaggerated and grievous punishments on yourself. I have sent you what I wrote recently on the topic, that no one can harm the one who does not injure himself. This is actually an entire essay that he wrote with her in mind, that also is in the NPNF, that Victorian collection of patristic writings. The discourse I am now sending, Your Excellency, fights the same battle.
Therefore, it's needful for you to read through it constantly. And if you are healthy enough, read it out loud. He's really getting specific now in giving her advice of how to drive away this despondency. Read what I've written. Even read it out loud. Talk to your soul. In one of the letters, he even says, sing to your soul. Do you ever do that, any of you? Talk to yourself? There's power in that. Real power. Talking to your soul. Yeah. Okay. For it will be a medicine, he says, sufficient for you if you wish it to be. Always coming back to her free will. Okay. We see in these exhortations, yes, the typical emphasis in all of Chrysostom's writings on the integrity and power of our free will, which is a central dimension in all of us of our being made in the image and likeness of God. We have free will because He's free, and He imparts that freedom to us. And that is not obliterated at the fall, right? In our Orthodox understanding, the freedom of the will may be damaged, but not obliterated at the fall. We can still choose the good. And how much more is this possible when we're asking God for His help, right, to choose the good? Okay, the rest of my presentation focuses on 7 kind of specific ways that St. John urges her, things he urges her to do, to relieve her of this despondency. So let me just say what they are, and maybe we can pick and choose a little bit which ones to emphasize. The first one we've just already mentioned, reading uplifting things. Remember how he said, read my letter over and over, even read it out loud, right? Okay, so that's good. That's important. Secondly, this is incredibly important, giving thanks to God in the midst of the trial. This is just so tremendously important. Maybe I could read one of my favorite passages here. Mary referred to the 3 holy ewes in the fire. Listen to what St. John says about that incident to his beloved Olivia. Would it not have been possible for God from the beginning to have prevented those 3 ewes from suffering their trial? Well, God's Pantocrator, right? He could have made sure that did not happen to them. But what's St. John saying? God did not wish for them to avoid that trial so that they could amass great profit. For this reason, God allowed them to be turned over into the hands of the barbarians, and the flames of the furnace to shoot up to an immeasurable height, and the wrath of the king to be enkindled more fearsomely than the furnace, and their hands and their feet to be tied extremely tightly, and they themselves to be thrown into the fire. And when all the onlookers gave up hope of their being rescued, then all at once, and beyond all hope, the mighty wonder-working power of God, the master craftsman, appeared, shining forth with exceeding brilliance. For the fire became bound, and the bound ones were delivered. And the furnace became a temple of prayer, a fountain of dew more awesome than the courts of kings. And fire, radiantly blazing, more powerful than iron and stone, and holding mastery over every other substance, was conquered by the strands of their hair. because not even a strand of their hair was burned, right? And an all-harmonious choir stood on that very spot. What do we celebrate? What do we sing Holy Saturday morning, right? The Song of the Three Children? It's their hymn of praise and thanksgiving in the midst of the fiery furnace. An all-harmonious choir stood on that very spot as the Holy One summoned all of creation under the marvelous melody. Remember how he summons the snow and the hail and the angels, everyone, everything. Praise God, right? Even in the midst of a fiery trial. They set up hymns of thanksgiving for having been bound and set on fire by their enemies, and for having been driven from their homeland, for having been made prisoners, for having been deprived of their freedom, for having been banished and made homeless wanderers, and for having to sojourn in a foreign and barbarous land. All of this was fitting for a prudent soul to be thankful. Wow. At the end of letter 10, he says, "So now, in bringing my discourse to a close, I ask your piety, as I never cease asking, that you be far removed from despondency, that you glorify God, which you have always done and are doing ceaselessly, but just kind of keep doing it, right? Rendering thanks to Him for all these cruel and onerous things. In this way, you will cultivate the most beautiful fruit. You will give a mortal wound to the devil. You will procure for us great consolation. With great ease, you will make the cloud of despair vanish, and you will enjoy pure tranquility. Do not become weakened, but rise up against that smoke, because if you wish, you will dissipate all this despondency more easily than if it were smoke, and make this manifest to us through your letters, so that even from afar, we still reap the fruit of great joy." Third, to make this list of seven things, right? Remember what Christ suffered and what others have suffered. Again, going back to that idea, the devil wants to make us think we're suffering more than anyone else. Well, what about Christ? You know. And as an example here, he does not really talk about the crucifixion. He talks about what he suffered even in his babyhood. Maybe he had that theme of exile in mind. There he is in exile, the three holy children in exile in Babylon. He says, "This man who was crucified, was he not from his birth an exile?" See, a fugitive. "And did he not have to flee with his whole family into exile in a foreign barbarous land when he was scarcely out of his swaddling clothes?" See? Okay, fourth is prayer. Now, you might wonder, well, why isn't that first? Everything with prayer. He knows she is such a woman of prayer that he actually only reminds her to pray once in all the letters. Pretty remarkable. I think he just took that for granted. But here is how he does remind her about the importance of prayer. "Therefore, do not let yourself be troubled by what's happening, and stop beseeching this or that person for help and running after shadows, for this is what human assistance amounts to. And instead, ceaselessly beseech Jesus, whom you serve, simply to give a nod. And in one moment of time, everything is brought into proper order. But if, on the other hand," he keeps going here, "if in beseeching him for help, the relief does not come about quickly, this is how he often works, not crushing the evils immediately, but when they come to a head, when they increase, when there remains almost nothing that has not been ravaged by the evils of the enemies, then all at once He changes everything to tranquility and leads things to an unexpected stability. So, you know, as we're asking God for his help, we just can't demand instant results all the time, right? Sometimes things happen more gradually. So we leave it to him. We have to, right? That's how we're always taught. Even in the Lord's Prayer, what's the Lord say how we should pray? Thy will be done, right? In your good time, not in our own time, right? Yeah, okay. Then the fifth, well, we've already dwelt on this a lot, watching your thought life. Yeah, having good, uplifting, helpful thoughts. Think about what you're thinking about, you know. This is so crucial, and we've been emphasizing this a lot. One particular thing to be thinking about, he says, is to always remember how fleeting this life is, right? Again, St. Paul, this world is passing away. In the whole sweep of eternity, right? This life is so short, so transient compared with eternity, right? He can say this, "For I have not stopped saying, and I will not stop saying, that there is only one thing, truly distressing, and that is sin." See, not any particular affliction or illness or hardship, but sin. That's what's distressing. Or what ought to be distressing, and of course, spurring us to avoid it. He says, everything else is dust and smoke. Really, in the end. For what is grievous about being in prison and being bound with a chain? He's talking from his own experience. What is grievous about suffering wretchedly when suffering wretchedly is the basis for such great gain, like we were saying earlier, right? Great rewards in heaven. What's grievous about exile? What's grievous about the loss, the confiscation of all one's property? These are empty things. Empty. Nothing to be afraid of. Nothing to be distressed about. And even if you speak of death, you speak of a debt due to nature that all of us must submit to sooner or later. And then he comes back. If you speak of exile, you speak of nothing else but seeing a new land and many cities. He's making light of it even. What's actually happened to him? And if you speak of the confiscation of one's goods, which has happened to him, he's lost everything, she's lost everything. You speak of liberty and being loosed from the burden of having to take care of all those things. Or as he says in letter 7, this is one of the great passages, I think, in the whole correspondence. Therefore, do not be cast down. For there is only one thing, Olympia, to fear. Only one real temptation. And again, he says, that's sin. That is sin. This is the refrain that I keep chanting to you ceaselessly. For everything else is ultimately a fable. Whether you speak of plots or enmities or deceptions or slanders or abuses or accusations or confiscations or banishments or sharpened swords or high seas or war engulfing the entire world. Whichever of these things you point to, they are transitory and perishable. They can only affect mortal bodies. They cannot in any way injure the watchful soul. This is why, he goes on, wishing to express the paltriness of both the good and the bad things of this present life, the blessed Paul stated the matter in one phrase saying, for the things that are seen are temporal. These things are passing away. 2 Corinthians 4:18. And then he urges her to think about the rewards that she is accumulating in heaven. We've already touched on that theme. The power of virtue. Let's move to this quickly. The sixth one in our list. The power of virtue. Doing the right thing is powerful. It's always powerful. For one thing, you're avoiding the wrong thing, right? That's powerful in itself. But to do the right thing, and especially, of course, the harder it is to do the right thing, the more powerful it is. And only God knows the repercussions, right, of when we do something right, something good. So this is also extremely important when we're in a state of despondency. God knows how hard it is. Chrysostom, we read that passage, right? He knows how vicious that grip of despondency is. When you just feel like the tiniest thing is such a monumental effort. And when you force yourself to make that effort, it's all the more valuable in God's sight, right? And just doing that one thing, when you feel like you can't do a single thing, that cracks. It's a crack in that despondency. And it can start melting away right from that, just from doing one good thing. I remember once I was I was really in kind of a bit of despondency, walking back into into our apartment building, and I saw someone digging in the garden. And I just wanted to avoid the person. Then I thought, the least I could do is help. He was an older woman. The least I could do, you know, is help her pull out a few weeds. And just doing that, just even starting to walk towards her, the darkness started lifting. So this is powerful. And then what's the seventh thing? Again, very important, and ties right into what I was saying. Helping someone else. Fighting despondency for someone else's sake. And I just grieve how many people take their own lives in the pit of despondency, depression, because they don't think really about how this is going to affect everyone else. And just to cry out, help me hang on, for my wife's sake, or my parents' sake, or my children's sake. Again, it breaks the power of that despondency. Chrysostom alludes to this twice in the letters. In letter 8, he says, "You can demonstrate your love for us if you attribute to what we have written as much power as if we had been present with you." He knows how much he misses him. You know, he misses her. "But let my letters," he says, "let my letters somehow convey my presence to you. You will show this clearly if we learn that you have become better. Your condition has improved through receiving and reading our letters. And not only better, but better by as much as we have greatly desired. And we have desired that your cheerfulness be as great now as the way it used to be when we were together." See? If we learn this, we, using the royal we, referring to himself, "we will be abounding in fruitful consolation even as we abide in this solitude. Therefore," he says, "if you wish to fill us," meaning himself, "with great joyfulness, which I know you wish for and have zealously pursued, show us that you have completely chased away the burden of despondency and that you are filled with calm, with peace," right? "Give us this recompense for our love and care for you."
I'm repeating actually a passage I read earlier. So, I'm saying, fighting for someone else is such a powerful weapon because it gets us out of ourselves. Whereas being all alone, fixated on our own problems, that's exactly where the devil wants us to be. Utterly alone. Utterly isolated. And kind of those thoughts hammering us, no one cares about how you feel, right? That's such lies from the evil one. Yeah. Thinking of someone else gets us out of our own little pity party. The devil wants us to cut off communication from everyone else, or even thinking about anyone else. In such a state, the very moment when we reach out in even the smallest way to someone else, as I've said, cracks the demonic spell over us, and our spirits begin to lift. And I add here, we are reminded of the saying of one of the saints, our brother is what? Our life. Our brother is our life.
Life.
That's a common saying among the monks especially. My brother is my life. As long as we remember that, we're living for someone else. We're not just caught in our own web, self-centeredness. So, these are the main ways that our great father among the saints, St. John the Golden Mouth, offers through these letters to his beloved spiritual daughter, St. Olympia, to help her and all of us to get out of and stay out of even the small traces of despondency, despair, and depression. And concerning the many varied ways of treatment of despondency, despair, and depression that are available in our own time, he's living many years before there were any psychotherapeutic drugs. Maybe I shouldn't say that. There may have been some kinds of things back then, but nothing like we have now, right? So it was all the more necessary to rely on these non-pharmaceutical avenues. But he would not have been averse, I'm sure, to whatever medicine can provide to help us out. It wouldn't have been an either or for him. He rejoiced one time when one of his friends sent him some medicine for his stomach, for instance. He was happy to get that, you know. So I think it's fair to say he would be favorably disposed towards whatever medical help might be necessary, especially, you know, as the despair gets more and more severe. So, may these letters from St. John to St. Olympia guide us and inspire us in all of our efforts with God's help to flourish in our life with Christ. And may they be particularly helpful if our foundations are ever shaken and if we ever do fall into a period of despondency or despair. So I end with a little prayer. Holy St. John Chrysostom, pray to God for us and thank you for all the love and care you bestowed upon St. Olympia through these letters and through them upon all of us. Amen. So, what do you think? You have something to say for us? 1600 years ago, still with us, right? With his words, with his love, with his prayers, still with us. Yeah. Yes?
I was just wondering if you might know, in Christian literature, church history, are there any other letters that are anywhere near this this level of?
Not that I know of. Okay. These are really a pinnacle. And I would even say in his own corpus, all of his writing. Now a lot of it, I haven't is still quite a bit of his work not even translated into English at all. But from what I have experienced, this is the pinnacle. He's pouring every ounce of his gift of eloquence to her. He's giving everything he's got to her. It's a pinnacle. I think I can honestly say that. I mean, you know, he's got tremendous eloquence everywhere in his writing, but this pitch, you know, and when you think they're just private letters, he didn't know for sure if they'd ever be read by anyone else. Maybe he had some idea that she would save them and, you know, others would read them, but he didn't know for sure. So he's giving all his heart, mind, and soul, all his tremendous powers of rhetoric. He's giving her everything he's got. Yeah.
And it's also the climax of his life, too.
It is. He's sealing his life with these words that are emanating from his exile itself. Absolutely. It is really like the crown of his career. He wrote something like 240 letters that come down to us. Must have been others that got lost. But of those 17 written to one person, it's by far more than he wrote to anyone else. So that says a lot in itself. He wrote to a number of other women. There were other deaconesses in the church. Someone calculated, I think about a quarter of his letters were written to women, whereas Augustine, only 7% were written to women. So that's interesting, too.
It's interesting that eventually you wrote a lot to women, and that each time is also the person who encouraged women choirs as well.
Women what?
Choirs?
Oh! Well, of course, they would have been singing in her monastery.
Right.
That he was the spiritual father for her. Yeah. So, certainly that, yeah. I'm not aware of his actually encouraging that in the great church, whether there were mixed choirs. Yeah, maybe. Could be. Could well be. Yeah. Yes?
I have a number of questions. Let me start with one and hopefully other questions. But the first one is really basic. Of those seven things, how did you come to the order?
Just for arbitrary name, I would say. Not necessarily ranking them.
He didn't rank any.
He didn't have any kind of... Of course, as a great rhetorician, it's almost like whatever he's emphasizing at the moment is the most important thing. He talks that way about virtue. You know, he'll say love is the highest virtue when he's talking about love. He'll say humility is the highest virtue when he talks about humility. He'll say almsgiving is the highest thing when he's talking about that. So, he's not a precise logician, you know, 1, 2, 3 ABC. He's not a systematic theologian. So they're all important. They all interweave. They're all overlapping.
Can you talk to us about what a deaconess means?
The deaconesses, they had a very specific role. Helping, because in that society, the women had their own quarters. And especially in the eastern part of the empire, more so than in the western part, the women's quarters in the homes were set aside. And you could not go into the women's quarters and minister to the sick, let's say, as a man. So the deaconesses did that. And then also with baptism, clothing. For modesty's sake, right? There were women who did the anointing of the females being baptized. So there were very real pastoral reasons for that order. Yeah, we just don't know what they might have done liturgically. And we know that it was never popular in the West at all, the office of deaconess. It was virtually unheard of in the West. In the East, it developed, probably the peak was Chrysostom's time. Then it gradually kind of got phased out. And one big reason was with more and more baptisms, with the society becoming more and more Christian, you'd have fewer and fewer adult baptisms and more infant baptisms. Yes?
For folks who really don't know very much about how many letters he wrote, or how many books he wrote, or how much material there is that can be attested to him.
Yeah.
Could you give us like some kind of overall feel or picture, and how does it compare with Augustine, and how many things have been translated and how many haven't, and so what's that picture like?
Yeah, well, in the NPNF, Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers, there are 14 volumes in the first series with a green, used to have green on the back, on the spine. Eight of those were Augustine, are Augustine. Six are Chrysostom. So that's a pretty fair, almost equal distribution. Of Chrysostom's writings, what got in the NPNF is just estimating a little more than half. Probably that's all. So you've got half of everything he wrote got translated in the 1880s in that great series, NPNF. I might be wrong, it might be less than half. Now, since then, Robert Hill has done a lot of translating of other sermons that did not appear in the NPNF, especially Old Testament sermons. There are none of those in the NPNF collection. He's got a whole series on Genesis that's it's powerful. Something like 80-some sermons on the book of Genesis, going through verse by verse, chapter by chapter. He's got a series on Isaiah 6. He has some on the Psalms, some on the prophetess Hannah, I think 5 sermons on her. 2 sermons on Saints Priscilla and Aquila. They're not in the NPNF. A lot of the saints' lives, sermons devoted to saints, none of those are in the NPNF. But St. Blas Press has a book, The Call of the Relic, The Call of the Saints, in their popular patristic series. It's the same series that this is in, that has 10 or 12 of his sermons dedicated to the martyrs. So there's still a lot of.
So how is it that some of his stuff has never been translated?
Yeah.
How much?
I don't know.
Yeah.
At least half.
Half.
At least half of this.
Most has been. Yeah. It's probably now like 2/3, counting what Hill's done, what other people have done. I did my reading in the 80s. So since then, 30 more years, a significant amount has been translated. So I would say roughly, from what I know, maybe 2/3. 3/4 of it has been translated by now. But I know in our library there's a set of 10 white volumes, all Chrysostom, and from what I can tell, most of that's never been translated. They're smaller volumes than the NPNF. Those are pretty hefty volumes, double column. There's a lot of material in those. Yeah, it's waiting. It's buried treasure. Waiting.
Is it kind of the same Greek as the New Testament, or slightly different?
It's a richer vocabulary. It's a richer vocabulary than the New Testament. And I think more difficult. The word order, longer sentences, sometimes very long sentences, sometimes quite a contorted word ordering. So it is different. And he's got a lot of classic overtones in his, even though he's writing 400 years after Christ,
you know, they always say the Attic Greek, the formal Attic Greek is tremendously rich compared to the Kine Greek of the New Testament. And then with Chrysostom, many echoes going back to that richer vocabulary and more kind of diverse word order.
When he was growing up, was he trained in the rhetorical schools?
Yes, he was trained by one of the greatest rhetoricians of all time, of the entire Greco-Roman period. Anyone know his name? Libanius. Libanius. L-I-B-A-N-I-U-S. Libanius. Great rhetorician in the classical mold. So Chrysostom had his gifts really developed, polished by this pagan rhetorician. It's remarkable. And in those years, maybe his mother was praying extra hard for him. He might have just had a career in rhetoric. Certainly he was brilliant enough. But at some point, he doesn't ever describe it himself. But there was a turning point where he laid aside that pagan learning, okay, and gave his life to Christ and serving the church. Yeah. And that's when he wanted to go into monastic life. And he had lost his father when he was very small. He probably didn't even know his father. So his mother appealed to him and said, "Please, John, don't make me a widow twice. Please stay with me until I die." And he did that then. Probably living, you know, semi-monastically at least, in their home until she passed on. Then he lived as a monk in the cave surrounding Antioch for several years and strained his health. And that was providential too, because if it hadn't been for that, he may have just been a recluse almost his whole life. Not even using those gifts of rhetoric. But the stomach ailment forced him to come back into the city, I guess for medical help, and then he was made a deacon, and 5 years later made a priest, 5 or 6 years later. And by then, with becoming a priest, he was given the main preaching duties in the cathedral in Antioch.
With Augustine, it seemed that during that time frame, when he spoke and gave sermons, there were, I believe, scribes who kind of could take notes.
That's what happened with Chrysostom.
Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Stenographers.
Stenographers who,
Shorthanding?
Shorthand.
Yeah. Taking his sermons down, getting them on paper. We really don't even know if he ever went back and did any editing. What we have comes across so conversational, you know, it's beautiful. It's like you're there. So, I kind of feel like he didn't do much editing. He was just so gifted off the top of his head, so to speak. Of course, he loved St. Paul. And there's the great story of why not? He was in his office or whatever, writing about St. Paul, commenting on Paul's letters, right? Every one of St. Paul's letters, we have commentary on by Chrysostom. And if I remember the story, the monk was passing by, looked through the keyhole, and saw St. Paul whispering in John's ear. And you know what is an ironclad confirmation of that story? On Mount Athos, the holy mountain where there are 20 Greek monasteries, Orthodox monasteries, mostly Greek, there is Saint John's skull is preserved, and the ear is incorrupt.
The ear
where Saint Paul was speaking to him is incorrupt, hasn't decayed. Has not decayed.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to venerate that ear, that skull. We're going, right? God willing. God willing, we're going. In January.
This January.
Thank you so much for your attention.
Yeah.
I guess I say this, so there's no write-ins with her responses.
We don't have her responses.
Do you think there's ever a chance there could be?
Oh, gosh. You never know. In some library somewhere, they might appear. Yeah, you never know. You never know. But, of course, she's sending it to him. He's an exile. They might have just destroyed. I mean, he was an enemy of the state. Impossible to believe. They might have just destroyed whatever he was carrying. He was on the way, being driven to a further state, a further location of exile.